Hare Krishna. Welcome to the Mahabharata character series. In this series, we will be discussing 14 fascinating characters from the Mahabharata, spanning over 4 generations. The Mahabharata is among the 2 most popular and influential books in the ancient literature of Vedic India. The Mahabharata and Ramayana together have shaped the hearts and inspired the lives of billions of people for millennia. What is so special about these 2 books? In the Vedic canon refers to the body of literature that are considered sacred or considered authoritative in a particular tradition. In the Vedic canon, there are a vast number of books, all of which have their importance. In the Itihasas, the speciality is that what is taught in principles, what is taught through logic, through analysis, in the Shrutis, in the Upanishads, that is taught through real life demonstrations. Now, there are 2 ways of instruction. One is didactic and the other is demonstrative. Didactic means thou shall not, thou shall not kill, thou shall not steal, thou shall not commit adultery. So thou shall not. Didactic, it's instruction. Now, didactic is important, no doubt. But in general, the heart doesn't connect it with didactic instructions very easily. But what is narrational? What is demonstrative? If instead, thou shall not be greedy. If instead, one tells a story, once upon a time, there was a person. And then we describe how that person was greedy and how that person caused ruin to others and ruin to oneself. Then that same lesson is demonstrated in a way that the heart and the head can both connect with. So, in the Vedic canon, there are these 2 broad bodies of literatures, the Shruti and the Smriti. So, Shruti give the principles in terms of analysis, especially the Upanishads are very abstract philosophical books, where also there are a few stories, but it's a lot of analysis. Now, the same principles that are taught in Shruti are taught in Smriti. The Smritis have 2 broad bodies of literature. In Smriti, there are Puranas and then there are the Itihasas. The Puranas refer to those bodies of literature which are compilations of narratives from vast periods of time. So the Puranas are a thematic anthology from multiple historical epochs. They don't focus on one particular phase in history. The Itihasas, the word Itihas means history in our context, and it means much more. Just like in Sanskrit, there is the word Prana. So Pranavayu isn't just oxygen. Oxygen is definitely important for our life, for our survival, but Pranavayu is much more. It is the whole composite of all the gaseous elements and their interactions which make life possible. So similarly, Itihas is not history in the sense in which it is understood in today's educational or academic setting. The Itihas are history definitely in the sense that there is a focus on a particular dynasty or a particular person or a particular set of persons. But that is narrated in such a way that instructions are conveyed. It's not just a dry anthology of dates and events. It's a living, transforming narration of incidents that may have happened millennia ago. But those incidents demonstrate principles which hold true even today. And by the understanding of those incidents and their underlying principles, we can get inspiration and guidance for our life even now. So that is the significance of the epics, the itihasas. So the itihasas and Puranas both focus on history, but itihasas focus on one particular character or one particular dynasty or one particular set of people. So the Ramayana focuses primarily on Lord Ram. It is Ramayana. Ayan means journey. So Ramayana is the journey of Lord Ram. It is the Mahabharata. So that focuses on the story of the descendant, it's of King Bharat. Mahabharata. Maha is the great. So Bharat was an illustrious king in the dynasty of the Kurus long ago, long before the Pandavas. And that's why those descendants in the dynasty are called as Bharatas. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna repeatedly refers to Arjuna as Bharata Rishabha, best among the Bharatas. So in the Mahabharat, the story of the greater Bharat. So Bharat was a king, and then Bharat also refers to a place. The word Bharat, Bha, is connected with the word Bhaskara. Bhaskara means sun. Bhaskara, that which gives light. So Bharata is that, Rata means that which is absorbed in. So Bharata is that which is absorbed in light. So Bharata refers to that part of the world which is absorbed in the light of spiritual knowledge. So spiritual culture was always present and prominent in India. The land that we call India, actually it has had many names. In the Vedic culture, it is referred to as Bharata or Bharatvarsha. And then the story of the greater Bharat. So it refers to both the person Bharat and his descendants and the area where he ruled and the events that transpired in that area at a particular time when some especially significant people were living and ruling. So this is Mahabharat. Now the word Maha is not just in terms of the greatness of the country or the greatness of the people who were the descendants of Bharat, but the Maha also applies in terms of the sheer size of the book. The Mahabharat is 110,000 verses. Actually, comparatively, the Srimad Bhagavatam is 18,000 verses. The Ramayana is around 24,000 verses. But the Mahabharat is a mind-boggling 110,000 verses. And prior to the Western world's discovery of the Vedic civilization and the discovery of the Mahabharat, prior to that, there were certain poems and compilations which came in the Greco-Roman tradition, from which modern European civilization has come. And those compilations were considered to be majestic, massive, mind-boggling. So Iliad and Odyssey were among these two very massive poems, literary compositions in the European tradition. But the Mahabharat is 7 to 8 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined together. That is how big it is. And studying it, just reading through it, can be a whole lifetime of joyfully absorbing engagement. Now, the Mahabharat is divided into 18 parvas. Parva is a division of a literary work. And the parvas are used to, just like we have chapters in a book, and then if a book is very long, then sets of chapters are brought together in sections. So a book may have 4 sections and each section may have 4 chapters. So like that, there are many, many chapters within each parva, but overall there are 18 chapters. The word 18, the number 18, has a lot of significance in the Mahabharat. There are 18 parvas in the Mahabharat. The war, that is the central pivot, the climax of the Mahabharat in one sense. Although the Mahabharat goes on for a much longer time after the war, But that is the heart of the Mahabharata in one sense. So that is all, the war lasted for 18 days. And similarly, the Bhagavad Gita, which is the most important nugget of wisdom. There are treasures of wisdom scattered throughout the 18 Paravas of the Mahabharata. But the most precious nugget of wisdom that is present in the Mahabharata is the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita also has 18 chapters in it. When we look at the Mahabharata, how do we relate with it? Actually, Srila Madhava Acharya has been among the various Acharyas. He has studied and commented on the Mahabharata quite extensively. And he has written a very important analytical study on the Mahabharata called as the Mahabharata Tatparya Niranaya. Tatparya means meaning, Niranaya means deciding or ascertaining. So what exactly is the meaning of the Mahabharata? That is to be ascertained. And that is what he does in this book. So therein he describes that the Mahabharata can be understood at three different levels. So one could be the literal or the historical. Second is the ethical. And the third is the transcendental. So let's understand this one by one. So the first is the literal or the historical. Now the literal or historical means this is how events happened. And because these events are connected with great personalities, there is the Supreme Lord who is present as Krishna and there is great devotees present. So just the literal narration of these events is potent, it is purifying. And it can free us from our many past sins and it can give us exciting, absorbing matter for thought, which as we contemplate on, purifies us and helps us move forward in our spiritual journey towards wisdom, towards enlightenment and towards pure love for Krishna and for his devotees who perform extraordinary, exciting, enlightening pastimes in this great classic. Now that's the first level where even if one does not do any analysis, one just hears the stories, that will be purifying. Like for the Mahabharata, it is said, and the same thing applies for the Ramayana, this is said, and it applies for the Mahabharata also. Ek ek aksharam pumsam mahapatakanashanam. Ek ek aksharam, one letter, what is the characteristic? Mahapataka nashanam. Pataka is sin. Mahapataka is great sins. So mahapataka nashanam. Great sins are destroyed by the recitation and the submissive oral reception, hearing of the Mahabharata or the Ramayana. It applies for both. Now, beyond that, there is the ethical level. Ethical level means that we learn ethical lessons from what has happened over here. From the events that have happened over there, we see, okay, Duryodhana was so greedy, so arrogant, so evil-minded. And one who becomes greedy, arrogant like this, will meet destruction. On the other hand, the Pandavas were virtuous, still they suffered so much. Although they suffered, eventually they were redeemed and they attained glory. So by studying the ethical dilemmas, by studying the character of the various characters in the Mahabharata, we can understand how ethical truths are demonstrated through history. How those who are virtuous ultimately are protected, redeemed and delivered. Dharmo rakshati dharma, as it is said. Dharma protects those who are adherents of dharma. So that is demonstrated at the ethical level. Beyond that, we can also learn from the specific ethical dilemmas that the characters in the Mahabharata face. Ethical dilemmas mean situations where one is not able to decide what is the right course of action. And how one who chooses a wrong course of action because of improper or incorrect understanding can bring ruin upon oneself and ruin upon others, even to the extent of ruin for the whole world. And then beyond that, there is the transcendental. Now, the transcendental is in two senses transcendental. One is that it is focused on the glorification of the Supreme Lord. That means whatever happens in the Mahabharata is ultimately the arrangement of the Lord for the glorification of His wisdom, His love, His glory, His grace. And this transcendental explanation can also involve some metaphorical explanations. Metaphorical means that something can be a symbol for something else. So one thing may be used as a representation for teaching something else. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna in the second chapter repeatedly says, Avinashitu tadviddhi yena sarvamidam tatam. He repeatedly explains that the soul is indestructible. In 2.17 he says, Avinashi, the soul can never be destroyed. Then a few verses later in 2.23, 2.24 he explains, Nainam chinnanti shastrani achedyoyam adayoyam. Repeatedly he says that the soul cannot be destroyed. And yet, the same Bhagavad Gita in the 16th chapter says, when talking about lust, anger and greed, Trividham narkasyedam dwaram nashanam atmanaha. Dwaram nashanam atmanaha. That lust, anger, greed, they are three things which are the gates to hell and they destroy the soul. Now, if earlier it was said that the soul cannot be destroyed, then how can lust, anger and greed destroy the soul? The Bhagavatam as well as the Ishopanishad also use the word Atmaha, the killer of the soul. What does this refer to? It refers to not the killing of the soul in a literal sense, because the soul is eternal, it can't be killed. But in the metaphorical sense, it means the soul's spiritual awareness, the soul's spiritual propensity, the soul's capacity for spiritual development is choked, is suppressed, is throttled. And that's what killing of the soul refers to. So in some cases, there are metaphorical explanations of the Mahabharata also. So the metaphorical explanation should supplement, not supplant, the literal explanation. Supplement means add to. Supplant means replace. Supplement means add to. That means the literal events actually happened, but through the literal events, there is some further significant thing which also can be learned. So supplant means to replace. Now, at the heart of the Mahabharata was a massive, destructive, fratricidal war. And this makes people very uncomfortable. The idea of a book which is filled with so much violence, why should such a book be glorified? And is it calling everyone to do violence like that? We will discuss about violence and whether what is the role of violence in the Mahabharata later. But it is significant that there are two parvas, Shanti Parva and Anushasan Parva, which happen at the end, after the conclusion of the war. So as I mentioned, there are 18 parvas in the Mahabharata, and five parvas, 6 to 10, they focus on the war. And after that, there are parvas where Bhishma and Yudhishthira discuss extensively, and the focus is on non-violence. So just now, there's a war has been fought, and both of them have fought in the war. And yet Bhishma says over there, non-violence is an extremely important principle of dharma. What does it mean? That means it's not that the Mahabharata is thoughtlessly or wantonly endorsing violence. There's a lot of deliberation. In fact, we will see the fifth parva, Udyoga parva. Udyoga is industry, work. So the industriousness of the Pandavas and of Krishna in trying to avoid the war. So they all tried their best to avoid the war. So it was not, the war was by no means the first recourse. After all other courses of action were tried and were turned out to be unsuccessful, only then war was taken as the last recourse. So some people try to say that the Kurukshetra war did not take place at all. And in this way, they try to say that the Mahabharata is not actually talking about violence. Now, Srila Prabhupada, one of the greatest teachers of the Vedic literature in the modern times, explained that this sort of explanation where we reject the historicity of the war does violence to the message, because the Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken just before the war happened, is a very grave book, and it is analyzing the course of action, and then it eventually describes how one can act at an enlightened level even in this world and even in activity which is as seemingly anti-enlightenment as a war. Generally, when people fight, we don't think of them as very cultured or civilized or enlightened people. You're fighting like animals. So normally war would be considered to be anti-enlightenment, but even an enlightened person may sometimes have to fight. Now, even when we want peace, sometimes the United Nations has to deploy a peacekeeping force. So force is required to have peace. Now force involves violence, peace involves lack of violence or absence of violence. So now just to maintain peace, just to prevent violence, some amount of force and violence may be required. So violence is a fact of life, and the Mahabharata doesn't fight shy from that in the name of some utopian pacifism. Utopian pacifism means some unrealistic idea that, oh, everyone should be peaceful, there should not be any violence. That sort of thing is not practical in real life. So the Mahabharata does not fight shy from the unpalatable realities of life. But at the same time, it also gives abandoned caution and wisdom about how to act and how to never rush into war thoughtlessly. So we are discussing all this because we are focusing on the point of metaphorical explanation. So the metaphorical explanation can be used to supplement, not supplant. So the Kurukshetra, can it represent, say, the human consciousness where there is a war going on between the forces of evil and the forces of good, and the forces of good are outnumbered by the forces of evil, the good virtuous desires within us are outnumbered by the vicious desires, and as a confrontation, but there is God on the side of virtue, and those who take shelter of God, even if they are outnumbered, still they will emerge victorious. Can such a metaphorical explanation be accepted? As long as it is not supplanting, as long as it is not used to replace the literal explanation, it can be used. So the important point is that this is something which the Bhagavad Gita talks about. Bhagavad Gita uses the metaphor of fighting for an inner war also. Krishna talks in 3.43 in the Bhagavad Gita how one should conquer over selfish desire, one should conquer over lust with determination. So there he uses the language of war. He says that evam buddhe param buddhva samstabhyatmanam atmanah jahi shatrum mahabaho kamarupam durasadam. So he uses the word shatru, enemy, jahi, win over, durasadam, formidable. So all these words are referring to the inner war, which is what is the Bhagavad Gita is talking about also. So there is inner war, and the Mahabharat setting can also be used to demonstrate the principles, or to illustrate or to understand the principles that are active in the inner war that happens in our own consciousness. So Kurukshetra is like the territory of our consciousness. And who is going to conquer that territory? Is it going to be virtue or is it going to be vice? So that is what is to be decided. And if we take shelter of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, as the Pandavas did, then we will be able to ensure that virtue triumphs and virtue conquers our heart. And then we live virtuously, and then we attain life's supreme perfection of pure love for God, and then we return to Him for life eternal. So the Mahabharat can be understood at a metaphorical level also, but that is something which is secondary. That is not the primary in terms of replacing the historical. It is something which supplements, not supplants, the literal understanding. So the literal, the ethical, and the transcendental. In the transcendental, we will see how they demonstrate the glories of Lord Krishna, and also how there are deeper meanings which apply to our life also. So when we will be discussing the Mahabharata, we are focusing on characters. The 18 Parvas, as I said, they span 110,000 verses and are a massive book. So the Adi Parva talks about the background, the birth of the Kuru elders, the birth of the Pandavas, the death of Pandu, the return of the Pandavas to the Kurukshetra, to Hastinapur. All that happens in Adi Parva. Then second Parva is Sabha Parva. So where Draupadi is disrobed and the Pandavas lose everything and then they are exiled. And third Parva is the Vana Parva. In the Vana Parva, the Pandavas are exiled and their adventures in forest are described. Their meetings with many great sages and many philosophical discussions are described in this also. Then fourth Parva is the Virat Parva, where the Pandavas live in Ajnatvas, in the kingdom of Virat. Fifth Parva is Udyog Parva, in which the Pandavas now finish their 13 years of exile and they are staying in the kingdom of Virat and they are making various arrangements to try to avoid war and at the same time considering the possibility, even the probability of war, they are also planning to get allies so that they will be equipped for the war. The sixth Parva is the Bhishma Parva. So this is the time when Bhishma was the commander. It is in this Bhishma Parva that the Bhagavad Gita is also spoken. And Bhishma was the commander for 10 days. And he was the longest reigning commander for the Kaurava army. Then for the next Parva is the Drona Parva. This is the seventh Parva. Drona was the commander for 5 days, 11 to 15. Then there is the Karana Parva. Karana was the commander for 16th and 17th days. Then there is Shalya Parva. Shalya was the commander for the 18th day, that's the 9th Parva. Then 10th Parva is called Sauptik Parva. Sauptik means sleep. So in sleep, Ashwatthama brutally assassinated all the Pandava warriors, except for the Pandavas and a few others. That is described in this Parva. Then there is the Stri Parva. All the women are devastated, heartbroken by the immense massacre that has happened, and their lamentation is described in this. Then there is Shanti Parva and Anushasan Parva, in which Bhishma gives instructions to Yudhishthira. Then after that there is Ashwamedhika Parva. Ashwamedhika Parva means there Yudhishthira Maharaj performs the Ashwamedha Yajna. Now in the Adi Parva he has performed the Rajasuya Yajna, but in the Ashwamedhik Parva he performs the Ashwamedha Yajna. This is in the 14th Parva. Then the 15th is the Ashram Vasik Parva, where Dhritarashtra, Gandhari, they renounce the world on the instructions of Vidura. 16th is the Maushala Parva, in which the Yadus fight and they destroy each other, and Krishna also departs from the world. 17th Parva is the Mahaprasthanaika Parva, in which the Pandavas, after hearing about the departure of Lord Krishna, they also depart towards the north. The Mahaprasthan, the great departure, the departure from which one never returns. And the last is the Swargarohan Parva, where the Pandavas attain higher destinations. Now, we will not be able to go through all the Parvas systematically, but we will focus on the central incidents in all the Parvas with respect to the most important characters. So, we will discuss characters from four generations. Bhishma and Drona from the oldest generation. There are many generations in the Mahabharata who are all there interacting. So Bhishma and Drona from the oldest generation, then we'll discuss about Dhritarashtra, Vidura, Gandhari from the next generation. From the next generation we'll discuss about Yudhishthir, Arjuna, Bhima, Duryodhana, Karana, Ashwatthama, Draupadi. And then in next generation we will discuss from about Abhimanyu. About Ghatotkach and some other characters from next generation we will discuss while we are discussing about Bhima or others with whom their interactions were there. So in this way we will go over the main story of the Mahabharata, and while discussing each of these characters we will discuss about some of the controversial aspects from their lives. We will try to clarify the controversies. We will also look at how they have demonstrated ethical principles that ring true, that hold true for us even now. And we will see how they also in their own way play some role, intentionally or unintentionally, in the unfolding of the plan of Lord Krishna, and how he is, although in the Mahabharata not a central character, the Pandavas and their activities are primarily described in the Mahabharata. There is an appendix to the Mahabharata called as Harivamsha, in which the Mahabharata, in which the activities of Lord Krishna, right from his childhood, are described. In the Mahabharata is not described much, but still, we'll see how although Krishna was not a central character, still he was in many ways the most important character, and how his role was so significant, and how ultimately the Mahabharata teaches many principles, but ultimately it teaches the principle of pure devotion. So in the Mahabharata itself, it is said that whatever is found elsewhere will be found here, but whatever is not found here will not be found anywhere else. That means the Mahabharata is like a compendium. So one can, if one wants, one can have material principles of material religiosity. We'll discuss what they mean. And then there can be principles of pure devotion. It's all there. And it's a massive compendium. We'll look at all this and we'll focus, while we are looking at the biographical analysis of the important characters of the Mahabharata, the principles of pure devotion, which more than everything else from the Mahabharata hold true now and hold true forever, because they address the heart's innermost longing for love and life eternal. And that ultimately is the promise of the scriptures, that those who hear the scriptures, understand the principles, they can attain life and love eternal. So from our next episode, we will start discussing about the oldest character who has a very important role in the full Mahabharata, that is Bhishma Pitamaha. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.